ever since Paley found his watch, the argument of design has been relied upon as unanswerable. The Church teaches that this world and all that it contains were created substantially as we now see them, that the grasses, the flowers, the trees, and all animals, including man, were special creations, and that they sustained no necessary relation to each other. The most orthodox will admit that some earth has been washed into the sea, that the sea has encroached a little upon the land, and that some mountains may be a trifle lower than in the morning of creation. The theory of gradual development was unknown to our fathers. The idea of evolution did not occur to them. Our fathers looked upon the then arrangement of things as the primal arrangement. The earth appeared to them as fresh from the hands of a deity. They knew nothing of the slow evolutions of countless years, but supposed that the almost infinite variety of vegetable and animal forms had existed from the first. Suppose that upon some island we should find a man 1,000,000 years of age, and suppose that we should find him in the possession of a most beautiful carriage, constructed upon the most perfect model. And suppose further that he should tell us that it was a result of several 100,000 years of labor and of thought, that for 50,000 years he used as flat a log as he could find, before it occurred to him that by splitting the log, he could have the same surface with only half the weight. That it took him many 1,000 years to invent wheels for this log, that the wheels he first used were solid, and that 50,000 years of thought suggested the use of spokes and tire. That for many centuries he used the wheels without linchpins. That it took 100,000 years more to think of using 4 wheels instead of 2. That for ages he walked behind the carriage when going downhill in order to hold it back. And that only by a lucky chance he invented the tongue. Would we conclude that this man from the very first had been an infinitely ingenious and perfect mechanic? Suppose we found him living in an elegant mansion, and he should inform us that he lived in that house for 500,000 years before he thought of putting on a roof, and that he had but recently invented windows and doors. Would we say that from the beginning he had been an infinitely accomplished and scientific architect? Does not an improvement in the things created show a corresponding improvement in the Creator? Would an infinitely wise, good, and powerful God, intending to produce man, commence with the lowest possible forms of life, with the simplest organism that can be imagined, and during immeasurable periods of time slowly and almost imperceptibly improve upon the rude beginning until man was evolved? Would countless ages thus be wasted in the production of awkward forms, afterwards abandoned? Can the intelligence of man discover the least wisdom in covering the earth with crawling, creeping horrors that live only upon the agonies and pangs of others? Can we see the propriety of so constructing the earth that only an insignificant portion of its surface is capable of producing an intelligent man? Who can appreciate the mercy of so making the world that all animals devour animals, so that every mouth is a slaughterhouse and every stomach a tomb? Is it possible to discover infinite intelligence and love in universal and eternal carnage? What would we think of a father who should give a farm to his children, and before giving them possession should plant upon it thousands of deadly shrubs and vines, should stock it with ferocious beasts and poisonous reptiles, should take pains to put a few swamps in the neighborhood to breed malaria, should so arrange matters that the ground would occasionally open up and swallow a few of his darlings, and besides all this, should establish a few volcanoes in the immediate vicinity, that might at any moment overwhelm his children with rivers of fire? Suppose that this father neglected to tell his children which of the plants were deadly, that the reptiles were poisonous, failed to say anything about the earthquakes, and kept the volcano business a profound secret. Would we pronounce him angel or fiend? And yet this is exactly what the Orthodox God has done. According to the theologians, God prepared this globe expressly for the habitation of his loved children, and yet he filled the forest with ferocious beasts, placed serpents in every pass, stuffed the world with earthquakes, and adorned its surface with mountains of flame. Notwithstanding all this, we're told that the world is perfect, that it was created by a perfect being, and is therefore necessarily perfect. The next moment, these same persons will tell us that the earth was cursed, covered with brambles, thistles, and thorns, and that man was doomed to disease and death, simply because our poor dear mother ate an apple contrary to the command of an arbitrary God. A very pious friend of mine, having heard that I had said that the world was full of imperfections, asked me if the report was true. Upon being informed that it was, he expressed great surprise that anyone could be guilty of such presumption. He said that, in his judgment, it was impossible to point out an imperfection. "Be kind enough," said he, "to name even one improvement that you could make if you had the power." "Well," said I, "I would make good health catching." instead of disease. The truth is, it is impossible to harmonize all the ills and pains and agonies of this world with the idea that we were created by and are watched over and protected by an infinitely wise, powerful, and beneficent God who is superior to and independent of nature. The clergy, however, balance all the real ills of this life with the expected joys of the next. We are assured that all is perfection in heaven. There the skies are cloudless. There all is serenity and peace. Here empires may be overthrown, dynasties may be extinguished in blood, millions of slaves may toil neath the fierce rays of the sun and the cruel strokes of the lash, yet all is happiness in heaven. Pestilences may strew the earth with corpses of the loved, the survivors may bend above them in agony, yet the placid bosom of heaven is unruffled. Children may expire vainly asking for bread, babes may be devoured by serpents, while the gods sit smiling in the clouds. The innocent may languish unto death in the obscurity of dungeons. Brave men and heroic women may be changed to ashes at the biggest stake, while heaven is filled with song and joy. Out on the wide sea, in darkness and in storm, the shipwrecked struggle with the cruel waves, while the angels play upon their golden harps. The streets of the world are filled with the diseased, the deformed, and the helpless. The chambers of pain are crowded with the pale forms of the suffering, while the angels float and fly in the happy realms of day. In heaven they are too happy to have sympathy, too busy singing to aid the imploring and distressed. Their eyes are blinded, their ears are stopped, and their hearts are turned to stone by the infinite selfishness of joy. The saved mariner is too happy when he touches the shore to give a moment's thought to his drowning brothers. With the indifference of happiness, with the contempt of bliss, heaven barely glances at the miseries of the earth. Cities are devoured by the rushing lava. The earth opens and thousands perish. Women raise their clasped hands towards heaven, but the gods are too happy to aid their children. The smiles of the deities are unacquainted with the tears of men. The shouts of heaven drown the sobs of the earth. Having shown how man created gods and how he became the trembling slave of his own creation, the questions naturally arise, how did he free himself even a little from these monarchs of the sky? From these despots of the clouds, from this aristocracy of the air? How did he, even to the extent that he has, outgrow his ignorant, abject terror and throw off the yoke of superstition? He noticed that whatever he might do, the motions of the planets were always the same, that eclipses were periodical, and that even comets came at certain intervals. This convinced him that eclipses and comets had nothing to do with him, and that his conduct had nothing to do with them. He perceived that they were not cause for his benefit or injury. He thus learned to regard them with admiration instead of fear. He began to suspect that famine was not sent by some enraged and revengeful deity, but resulted often from the neglect and ignorance of man. He learned that diseases were not produced by evil spirits. He found that sickness was occasioned by natural causes, and could be cured by natural means. He demonstrated, to his own satisfaction at least, that prayer is not a medicine. He found by sad experience that his gods were of no practical use, as they never assisted him, except when he was perfectly able to help himself. At last he began to discover that his individual action had nothing whatever to do with strange appearances in the heavens, that it was impossible for him to be bad enough to cause a whirlwind, or good enough to stop one. After many centuries of thought, he about half concluded that making mouths at a priest would not necessarily cause an earthquake. He noticed, and no doubt with considerable astonishment, that very good men were occasionally struck by lightning, while very bad ones escaped. He was frequently forced to the painful conclusion, and it's the most painful to which any human being was ever forced, that the right did not always prevail. He noticed that the gods did not interfere in behalf of the weak and innocent. He was now and then astonished by seeing an unbeliever in the enjoyment of most excellent health. He finally ascertained that there could be no possible connection between an unusually severe winter and his failure to give a sheep to a priest. He began to suspect that the order of the universe was not constantly being changed to assist him because he repeated a creed. He observed that some children would steal after having been regularly baptized. He noticed a vast difference between religion and justice, and that the worshippers of the same God took delight in cutting each other's throats. He saw that these religious disputes filled the world with hatred and slavery. At last he had the courage to suspect that no God at any time interferes with the order of events. He learned a few facts, and these facts positively refused to harmonize with the ignorant superstitions of his fathers. Finding his sacred books incorrect and false in some particulars, his faith in their authenticity began to be shaken. Finding his priests ignorant upon some points, he began to lose respect for the cloth. This was the commencement of intellectual freedom. The civilization of man has increased just to the same extent that religious power has decreased. The intellectual advancement of man depends upon how often he can exchange an old superstition for a new truth. The Church never enabled a human being to make even one of these exchanges. On the contrary, all her power has been used to prevent them. In spite of the Church, however, man found that some of his religious conceptions were wrong. By reading his Bible, he found that the ideas of his God were more cruel and brutal than those of the most depraved savage. He also discovered that his holy book was filled with ignorance, and that it must have been written by persons wholly unacquainted with the nature of the phenomena by which we are surrounded. And now and then, some man had the goodness and courage to speak his honest thoughts. In every age, some thinker, some doubter, some investigator, some hater of hypocrisy, some despiser of sham, some brave lover of the right, has gladly, proudly, and heroically braved the ignorant fury of superstition for the sake of man and truth. These divine men were generally torn in pieces by the worshippers of the gods. Socrates was poisoned because he lacked reverence for some of the deities. Christ was crucified by a religious rabble for the crime of blasphemy. Nothing is more gratifying to a religionist than to destroy his enemies at the command of God. Religious persecution springs from a due admixture of love towards God and hatred towards man. The terrible religious wars that inundated the world with blood tended at least to bring all religion into disgrace and hatred. Thoughtful people began to question the divine origin of a religion that made its believers hold the rights of others in absolute contempt. A few began to compare Christianity with the religions of heathen people, and were forced to admit that the difference was hardly worth dying for. They also found that other nations were even happier and more prosperous than their own. They began to suspect that their religion, after all, was not of much real value. For 300 years, the Christian world endeavored to rescue from the infidel the empty sepulcher of Christ. For 300 years, the armies of the cross were baffled and beaten by the victorious hosts of an impudent impostor. This immense fact sowed the seeds of distrust throughout all Christendom, and millions began to lose confidence in a God who had been vanquished by Muhammad. The people also found that commerce made friends, where religion made enemies, and that religious zeal was utterly incompatible with peace between nations or individuals. They discovered that those who loved the gods most were apt to love men least, that the arrogance of universal forgiveness was amazing, that the most malicious had the effrontery to pray for their enemies, and that humility and tyranny were the fruit of the same tree. For ages, a deadly conflict has been waged between a few brave men and women of thought and genius upon the one side, and the great ignorant religious mass on the other. This is a war between science and faith. The few have appealed to reason, to honor, to law, to freedom, to the known, and to happiness here in this world. The many have appealed to prejudice, to fear, to miracle, to slavery, to the unknown, and to misery hereafter. The few have said, think. The many have said, believe. The first doubt was the womb and cradle of progress, and from that first doubt man has continued to advance. Man began to investigate, and the Church began to oppose. The astronomer scanned the heavens, while the Church branded his grand forehead with the word infidel. And now not a glittering star in all the vast expanse bears a Christian name. In spite of all religion, the geologist penetrated the earth, read her history in books of stone, and found, hidden within her bosom, souvenirs of all the ages. Old ideas perished in the retort of the chemist, and useful truths took their places. One by one, religious conceptions have been placed in the crucible of science, and thus far, nothing but dross has been found. A new world has been discovered by the microscope. Everywhere has been found the infinite. In every direction man has investigated and explored, and nowhere, in earth or stars, has been found the footstep of any being superior to or independent of nature. Nowhere has been discovered the slightest evidence of any interference from without. These are the sublime truths that enabled man to throw off the yoke of superstition. These are the splendid facts that snatched the scepter of authority from the hands of priests. In that vast cemetery called the past are most of the religions of men, and there too are nearly all their gods. One by one the myths have faded from the clouds. One by one the phantom host has disappeared, and one by one facts, truths, and realities have taken their places. The supernatural has almost gone, but the natural remains. The gods have fled, but man is here. Nations, like individuals, had their periods of youth, of manhood, and decay. Religions are the same. The same inexorable destiny awaits them all. The gods created by the nations must perish with their creators. They were created by men, and like men, they must pass away. The deities of one age are the bywords of the next. The religion of our day and country is no more exempt from the snare of the future than the others have been. When India was supreme, Brahma sat upon the world's throne. When the scepter passed to Egypt, Isis and Osiris received the homage of mankind. Greece, with her first valor, swept to empire, and Zeus put on the purple of authority. The earth trembled with the threat of Rome's intrepid sons, and Jove grasped with mailed hand the thunderbolts of heaven. Rome fell, and Christians from her territory, with the red sword of war, carved out the ruling nations of the world, and now Christ sits upon the old throne. Who will be his successor? Day by day, religious conceptions grow less and less intense. Day by day, the old spirit dies out of book and creed. The burning enthusiasm, the quenchless zeal of the early church have gone, never, never to return. The ceremonies remain, but the ancient faith is fading out of the human heart. The worn-out arguments fail to convince, and denunciations that once blanched the faces of a race excite in us only derision and disgust. As time rolls on, the miracles grow mean and small, and the evidences our fathers saw conclusive utterly fail to satisfy us. There is an irrepressible conflict between religion and science, and they cannot peaceably occupy the same brain nor the same world. While utterly discarding all creeds and denying the truth of all religions, there is neither in my heart nor upon my lips a sneer for the hopeful, loving, and tender souls who believe that from all this discord will result a perfect harmony, that every evil will in some mysterious way become a good, and that above and over all there is a being who, in some way, will reclaim and glorify every one of the children of men. But for those who heartlessly try to prove that salvation is almost impossible, that damnation is almost certain, that the highway of the universe leads to hell, who fill life with fear and death with horror, who curse the cradle and mock the tomb, it is impossible to entertain other than feelings of pity, contempt, and scorn. Reason, observation, and experience, the holy trinity of science, have taught us that happiness is the only good, that the time to be happy is now, and the way to be happy is to make others so. This is enough for us. In this belief we are content to live and die. If by any possibility the existence of a power superior to and independent of nature shall be demonstrated, there will then be time enough to kneel. Until then, let us stand erect. Notwithstanding the fact that infidels in all ages have battled for the rights of man, and have at all times been the fearless advocates of liberty and justice, we are constantly charged by the Church with tearing down, without building again. The Church should by this time know that it's utterly impossible to rob men of their opinions. The history of religious persecution fully establishes the fact that the mind necessarily resists and defies every attempt to control it by violence. The mind necessarily clings to old ideas until prepared for the new. The moment we comprehend the truth, all erroneous ideas are of necessity cast aside. A surgeon once called upon a poor cripple and kindly offered to render him any assistance in his power. The surgeon began to discourse very learnedly upon the nature and origin of disease, of the curative properties of certain medicines, of the advantages of exercise, air, and light, and of the various ways in which health and strength could be restored. These remarks were so full of good sense and discovered so much profound thought and accurate knowledge that the cripple, becoming thoroughly alarmed, cried out, "Do not, I pray you, take away my crutches. They are my only support, and without them I should be miserable indeed." "Well, I am not," said the surgeon, "going to take away your crutches. I am going to cure you, and then you will throw the crutches away yourself." For the vagaries of the clouds, the infidels proposed to substitute the realities of earth. For superstition, the splendid demonstrations and achievements of science. And for theological tyranny, the chainless liberty of thought. We do not say that we have discovered all, that our doctrines are the all-in-all of truth. We know of no end to the development of man. We cannot unravel the infinite complications of matter and force. The history of one monad is as unknown as that of the universe. One drop of water is as wonderful as all the seas, one leaf as all the forests, and one grain of sand as all the stars. We are not endeavoring to chain the future, but to free the present. We are not forging fetters for our children, but we are breaking those our fathers made for us. We are the advocates of inquiry, of investigation, and thought. This of itself is an admission that we are not perfectly satisfied with all our conclusions. Philosophy has not the egotism of faith. While superstition builds walls and creates obstructions, science opens all the highways of thought. We do not pretend to have circumnavigated everything and to have solved all difficulties, but we do believe that it is better to love men than to fear gods, that it is grander and nobler to think and investigate for yourself than to repeat a creed. We are satisfied that there can be but little liberty on earth while men worship a tyrant in heaven. We do not expect to accomplish everything in our day, but we want to do what good we can and to render all the service possible in the holy cause of human progress. We know that doing away with gods and supernatural persons and powers is not an end. It is a means to an end, the real end being the happiness of man. Felling forests is not the end of agriculture. Driving pirates from the sea is not all there is of commerce. We are laying the foundations of the grand temple of the future, not the temple of all the gods, but of all the people, wherein with appropriate rites will be celebrated the religion of humanity. We are doing what little we can to hasten the coming of the day when society shall cease producing millionaires and mendicants, gorged indolence and famished industry, truth in rags and superstition robed and crowned. We are looking for the time when the useful shall be the honorable, and when reason, throned upon the world's brain, shall be the King of Kings and God of Gods.